very small amounts and are involved in making our white and red blood cells. These compounds are also found in human breast milk. There are 10 times more AKG compounds in breast than in cow's milk. And these are thought to make a significant contribution to an infant's immune system. Dr. Bruchholt discovered that shark liver oil stopped cancer proliferation and radiation sickness. A study on cervical cancer patients taking SLO before, during, and after radiotherapy found that it reduced radiation-induced injuries by a very significant 50%. Dr. Bruchholt suggests a dose of 0.3 to 2.6 grams will help minimize the associated decrease in platelets and white blood cells that accompany radiation treatment. The mighty shark's resistance to cancer was mistakenly thought to be attributed to shark cartilage after William Lane published his book Sharks Don't Get Cancer in 1992, reporting that this was the secret ingredient. The medical profession were quick to damn this suggestion after repeated experiments with shark cartilage failed to show any direct cancer-killing effects. After that, anything shark-related was tainted, and it caused much uproar when it was discovered that William Lane's son was selling shark cartilage products. Shark liver oil contains four anti-cancer substances: squalene, omega-3, alkyl glycerol, and squalamine. The substance squalene has a partial inhibitory feedback loop on the mevalinate pathway, the same growth pathway used by cancer cells to make cholesterol that's blocked by statin drugs, as I would learn later. Statins are particularly effective for blood cancers. The alkyl glycerol component of shark liver oil has an immune-stimulating effect, improving the production of all the blood components, hematopoiesis, so it reduces side effects of radiotherapy, also boosting white cell counts and improving platelet counts during chemotherapy. There was a suggestion that taking shark liver for several months might thicken the blood too much. But most patients' blood counts suffer horribly with the traditional treatments, as mine did. I wish I'd discovered it earlier. The alkyl glycerols also perform another important function alongside their immune-boosting effects. They reduce a key growth factor that promotes angiogenesis called basic fibroblast growth factor. And the squalamine content is causing much excitement amongst researchers for its antiviral effects. Sharks have a rudimentary immune system, but are surprisingly resistant to viral infections. Viruses are known cofactors associated with many cancers. Rather than fighting the virus directly, it makes the blood and liver resistant to infection by kicking off proteins that stick to the inside of blood vessels. These proteins are a source of food for some viruses, and without them, the viruses are starved to death. Squalene is also found at lower levels in olive oil, 0.7% versus circa 40% in SLO, and amaranth oil, 6 to 8%, which of course are more environmentally friendly. I blush with shame at my use of shark liver oil, but it was the only option I knew about. It's this component that may make extra virgin olive oil especially good at fighting cancer, not just the much-touted oleic acid. I use lashings of it on my food. I still have a couple of spoonfuls first thing every day, even now, along with cod liver oil for its omega-3 DHA and EPA anti-inflammatory effect. Fish liver oils are also a natural and balanced source of vitamins A and D, both essential for the PPAR gamma pathway. I am hoping that alkyl glycerols are now available without damaging the populations of those majestic sea creatures. If you do decide to take shark liver oil, perhaps take for 3 months only as I did, as this may be enough to have a long-lasting effect on your immunity. Was I winning? I couldn't be absolutely sure, but regular blood tests helped confirm that for now I was doing all right. I was staying within normal limits. I had to keep blind faith that I was on the right track. The diet was especially hard to maintain. I no longer craved the sweet foods, but could I never let my hair down again? Was my future to be lived on a knife edge, checking foods all the time, unable to go out and allow myself a couple of cheeky drinks? Was there no easier way? Chapter 9. Beating the Odds. Each month I tracked my blood markers. Even as a physiotherapist, I had been taught that stage 4 meant certain death. It was unavoidable. The cancer would come back. I tried hard to block out the negative thoughts. I refused to believe it. I knew starving the cancer and halting its growth was key to preventing an unwelcome return. It was tough going, sticking to the diet, but I learnt to adapt and soon realized that all those unhealthy foods I'd eaten in the past, I really didn't miss. Well, maybe watching others tucking into a bacon sandwich on a Sunday morning still made me yearn wistfully for a bite. As my blood markers remained within normal levels, my faith in my own abilities was slowly growing. And as self-doubt faded, I began to feel so confident in my progress that I threw myself back into the toiletries business I'd started just before the diagnosis of secondary cancer in my lungs. It was certainly a welcome distraction from the dreary hospital appointments, the nail-biting wait for results, and the sad and sorry looks from the medical staff. I could see what they were thinking. They'd all been taught the same dogma. Stage 4. I wonder how long she's got. In the hospital, I was constantly putting up barriers to the undercurrent of negativity I knew was lurking just below the surface. I was not immune to thoughtless off-cuff remarks from the staff. My inner equilibrium could be knocked off balance by the slightest hint of pessimism. "I am really pleased with my progress," I said to a nurse taking my blood pressure. "Let's hope I can keep it at bay now." "When it comes back, I'm sure there'll be many new therapies to consider." "Don't you mean if?" I replied, shocked at her lack of empathy. I bet I knew more about how to control my cancer than she did. How dare she assume progression was inevitable? It made my resolve even stronger. At home, I was juggling sales meetings, new toiletries formulations, creating designs for bottles, tubes, and gift boxes, and sourcing production from all over the world. Creating a brand new product range was exciting. It was also a kind of organized chaos, an antidote to my structured and scheduled medical regime. A period of extreme multitasking is how I would describe these years. But I always put aside 20 minutes for daily meditation. I did this immediately after my morning supplements. I made time for a bike ride or a brisk walk to the park after lunch. This was surely boosting my immunity, oxygenating my blood, and allowing my body to soak up any glucose released from my food. Starve cancer. It became my mantra. I would chant it as I marched briskly around the block or the park, squeezing each buttock in turn with every step as I did so, hoping no one noticed my bizarre bottom-clenching gait. I would stop occasionally to do a few knee squats by a bench. I wanted to make sure my gluteus maximus, the biggest muscle in our bodies, was getting a decent workout. It didn't take a genius to work out it'd be the ideal one to target, along with the quads in the thighs. Muscles make up 40% of our body mass and provide a valuable sink to soak up excess glucose. Exercise also increases insulin sensitivity in the tissues, so it becomes ever more efficient at taking up the glucose and using it. Even with the distraction of starting a business, I was still learning and assimilating new cancer information and trying to formulate a new anti-cancer strategy. If, after everything I'd done, the cancer made its return, I would need a contingency plan. I continued to buy survivor stories, huge tomes on alternative medicine, and many other books and journals. My home cancer library now filled several shelves. I still felt sure there were other big guns I might have missed. Green tea, with its powerful ingredient Epigallocatechin gallate, EGCG, was definitely one. But it only had a short half-life, so I would need to drink it constantly through the day, sometimes as many as 10 cups. Other natural compounds were also big guns. Curcumin targeted inflammatory pathways, while genestin, cerebinin, milk thistle, quercetin, and resveratrol all seemed to stop cancer growing and spreading. All became constants in my routine, alongside my supplement cocktail and morning juice of beetroot, celery, carrot, and apple. Quite how they might starve cancer, I'd yet to find out. But each seemed to be very effective from the research I'd seen on their cancer-killing and angiogenesis-blocking activity. All were taken at every mealtime. There seemed to be no one-size-fits-all for diet. Each complementary doctor had an individual style of treatment, yet all focused on rectifying deficiencies of vitamins and minerals, e.g. magnesium and A, B, D, K vitamins, or adding supplements that would enhance other treatments. But more than anything, they were all completely against sugar. Making vegetable juices, exercising, home cooking, sourcing healthy food, exploring new ones, researching, meditating, hospital appointments, the business. It all took time. This was hardly the kind of lifestyle I would recommend to anyone just out of a terminal diagnosis. It was exhausting. In the evenings, I would slide into a warm, naturally fragranced bath, light candles, play music, and relax for half an hour. Shutting out the hustle and bustle of the day was important. I needed my own little sanctuary just for thinking, or not thinking. It became my nightly refuge. In the end, I created my own Tranquility Spa CD, a relaxation ritual with a bit of reflexology, affirmations, and visualizations all included, designed primarily for myself. But later I packaged it up as a gift pack with candles, mineral-rich bath salts, and a bath pillow. When I launched, the pack was shortlisted for Gift of the Year. Bath time was a great place to ponder life, business, my cancer, and all its complexities. Once I had calmed my racing thoughts, I would think about how my cancer was behaving and try and see the bigger picture. I had no detectable cancer in my body, but I was not about to sit back and rest. It could pounce at any time. When it comes back, were the words that always haunted me. The wily cancer cell had been able to steal my body's nutrients, blood supply, and immunity, and it had used all these against me. How could I outwit this parasite? Parasites thrive and reproduce unabated until either their food source runs out or the host dies. Sadly, with cancer, it is usually the latter. How to starve cancer without starving and damaging myself? On the outside, it appeared to be super powerful, able to resist the most toxic of treatments, to mutate just when you thought you were getting the upper hand. A cunning little beast. But was it really powerful, or did it just reroute itself down whichever path was left unblocked? What if you blocked all the routes? How many were there? Was it an impossible task to find out? Was it just IGF-1 and aerobic glycolysis, the Warburg effect? If so, then why was it so hard to treat? There must be other metabolic pathways that needed blocking. Cancer research was getting more reductive, scientists examining smaller and smaller parts of the cancer genome, and then turning their attention to the immune system when the genomic treatments failed them. What had gone wrong with the patient's immunity to allow the cancer to thrive? What had come first, the altered immunity or the cancer? What if the altered immunity was a result of an altered metabolism and inflammation? If so, targeting the immune system would be futile.